Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Downhome Sound, Diversity and Politics in Americana Music by Mandy Bates Bailey. Foreword by Guy Davis. Narrated by Marnie Penning. Publisher's note: in this audio edition, you will hear references to graphs, tables, and charts present in the print and ebook formats of the book. Foreword. Americana has a lot of moving parts. Focusing on the sound of the music in isolation obscures the importance of the storytelling and the environment. That approach also relegates the music to passive description about historical moments. The music becomes a soundtrack rather than a tool. Understanding culture is vital to understanding those of us who see ourselves as, at least partially, in the Pete Seeger tradition. For us, we are teachers and artists that use the music to impact as well as inform. President Barack Obama underscored not only Seeger, but the social value in American roots music in a statement following the singer's 2014 death. Once called America's tuning fork, Pete Seeger believed deeply in the power of song, he professed. But more importantly, he believed in the power of community, to stand up for what's right, speak out against what's wrong, and move this country closer to the America he knew we could be. Over the years, Pete used his voice and hammer to strike blows for workers' rights and civil rights, world peace, and environmental conservation. And he always invited us to sing along. For reminding us where we come from and where we need to go, we will always be grateful to Pete Seeger. This statement reflects the role of community and the power of the music to do more than describe. I call myself an American roots musician. I'm in folk, I'm in the blues, I have a one-man play, but they're all part of each other. Americana just works that way. It's a culture that embraces different musical styles, attracts diverse people, and conveys a message, either directly through lyrics or implicitly by reflecting the environment it binds together. This book assesses Americana in that vein. It considers the message, those of us who write slash sing those messages, the audience that seeks them out, and the ultimate effect on people who don't identify with the Americana culture at all. Reaching beyond the community to grow and educate is pivotal. But this research tells us that potential is great, but growth is hard and brings additional challenges. That message sounds like a lot of what we do in this culture. We can't be afraid to talk or sing about our own struggles. That's a key to what we do. It keeps us authentic and allows our message to resonate. If wide exposure dulls that impact, do we even want it? How can we not if the exposure could inform and open hearts and minds? The question and answer are circular. Well-written songs often carry that burden to entertain while encouraging deeper contemplation. The nature of artists like me is to expand beyond a narrowly defined musical or even broad artistic space, much like the nature of music in this culture is to transcend boundaries. To that end, we don't provide the answers as much as we create a space for others to question the world, the country, and even themselves. This book describes the artists, the music, the community, and teaches us that Americana is more than a soundtrack, but mostly it generates important questions that aren't easy to answer. Guy Davis. Preface. Certainties relating to Wikipedia. It's flawed, and it's pervasive. Indeed, most objects, prominent people, and places have a Wikipedia page. Round Pond, Maine does not. Try looking for Round Pond in Wikipedia, you'll be directed to nearby Bristol. Jenny Cleaves describes Round Pond as a darling little fishing village. Appreciation for rural Maine and her children leaked into every aspect of our morning conversation. Two things were certain following that dialogue. I wanted to see Slade, Jenny's son, and Rod Picott perform together live. And I wanted to visit Round Pond before the circus arrives. It's ridiculous, Jenny says, of the multi-million-dollar homes being constructed near quaint New England cottages. Slade Cleaves wasn't born in Round Pond or in South Berwick, Maine, where he was raised, however. Cleaves was born in Washington, D.C. in 1964, while his father was a graduate student in psychology at George Washington University. The 1960s were a tumultuous decade generally, but D.C. saw protests. Its residents were finally given the right to vote for president with the ratification of the 23rd Amendment, and the Civil Rights Act of 1964 was passed. Slade's parents wanted to raise him and the three children that followed in a less turbulent environment. The resultant move to a South Berwick farm provided a more provincial setting where the Cleaves children could learn about life as well as human behavior. Jenny is quick to note of her then-husband, Craig. There were no psychologists up here in the 70s. He worked in clinics, and Slade learned about life at the table. According to Jenny, her son was always introspective and writing. In the second grade, Slade's interest in music joined his interest in writing when she took him to a sale held at a South Berwick convent, where she bought an upright piano for $25. Not long after his mother purchased the piano, Slade met a kindred spirit in Rod Picott. A year younger than Slade, Rod jokes that they identified as writers even then. Slade even recalls a conversation riding the school bus home about wanting to be artists when they grew up. He says fans get a kick out of their history. Seeing why is as easy as seeing their link to what would become the Americana format. Both appreciate acoustic music and songwriting, and I've lost count of the Tom Petty and Bruce Springsteen references in our conversations. Upon discovering an error in one of my early drafts of this book, in which I referred to Rod as Roderick, Slade emailed, writing, "Only my mom, and the IRS, I suppose, calls Rod Roderick." Slade's teasing smirk came through, and I knew I had to talk to Jenny. Slade and Rod maintained their songwriting dream throughout childhood. Slade recalls grudgingly accepting piano lessons when he wanted to learn guitar. He performed Beethoven for his year-end recital when he was 15. He performed Springsteen's Jungle Land, complete with saxophone accompaniment, the following year for his final recital. Jenny recounts the performance with great pride. She later learned Springsteen served as a catalyst for Slade to pick up the guitar. Demonstrates how powerful a stripped-down acoustic album can be, Slade says of Springsteen's Nebraska. Jenny and Rod, whom she indeed consistently refers to as Roderick, recall a more difficult early educational path for Rod. He saw the Cleaves home as a refuge from the turmoil of his own. He addresses his adolescent angst and brooding behavior in ways that leave one thinking a song he co-wrote with Slade, Black T-Shirt, 2009, is at least semi-autobiographical. Nevertheless, despite the darkness that is a frequent undercurrent in his music, I have difficulty seeing the smiling, affable man that frequently laughed and ran his fingers through his hair during our first meeting as perpetually brooding. Perhaps this is a lesson from both Slade and Rod's songwriting, pushing forward, yet rooted in experience. Jenny used the word hopeful to describe the way her son and his friend address struggle, strife, and emotional challenges in their writing. My characterization was dignified. Hers is better. He was always very tall and very intellectual, Jenny says of Rod. She worked as a tutor in the elementary school he and Slade attended, recommending Rod, then a year behind his friend, be advanced a grade. His high school administrators finally agreed, and the pair graduated at the same time. Could there really have been another outcome? Slade and Rod have different approaches, but reach the same conclusion when describing their first public performance. Logistical details play large in Slade's description. Emotion colors Rod's. The former involves planning, band names, and choice of music. I get the sense that Slade approaches writing and performing as if taking disparate pieces from a variety of puzzles and creating something intriguingly new. My impression of Rod is that feelings wash over him and he rolls with them. It was a complete disaster. At the end of three songs, we were completely demoralized, Rod says of the first time he and Slade played publicly together at a high school assembly. He ripped all the strings from his guitar afterward. Emotion and problem solving have played into their approaches to building careers as well. Slade and his wife Karen searched for music towns after he finished college in Boston. Desiring to further his career away from the Boston expense, traffic, and weather, and inspired by the 1991 Rolling Stone headline, Heaven with a Texas Zip Code, the couple road-tripped to the Lone Star State. According to Slade, Seattle was too wet, Minneapolis was too cold, Athens seemed to be fading, but Austin? Rod, on the other hand, landed in Boulder, Colorado, and later moved to Nashville, where he felt his star rise. Somehow I'd gotten it in my head that I could move to Nashville and become a staff writer at one of the big publishing companies. This is sort of funny because looking back, there was nothing indicating that this was at all possible. Nevertheless, he arrived in Tennessee and resolved to improve his writing, looking to the likes of giants such as Lucinda Williams, John Prine, and Guy Clark. Slade admits to being insular and protective of his work initially, but he could trust Rod. I knew that he was not going to bring something out of left field to the table that I'd have to politely decline. And even more importantly, I knew that he could be honest with me and point out with a thoughtful argument why an idea of mine was not up to snuff. With 50 years of friendship behind them and more than 800 miles between them, Slade and Rod still write together, and trust still characterizes their process. We know each other so well that we don't have to dance around a song we're working on. We are very blunt. I remember a writing session at his home when he first moved to Austin and Slade's wife thought we were fighting. We were simply writing, Rod says, before becoming deferential to Slade. He's very skilled where I'm weak, and I'm quite good at his weakness, if he has one. A nearly lifelong regard and mutual admiration has colored my communication with the two men. Slade has said on multiple occasions that Rod doesn't get the credit he deserves, while Rod frequently addresses the beauty in Slade's voice. They seem to straddle the fence between little boys vociferously defending teammates and grown men recognizing that one's heroes are closer than realized. Notably, Slade read a poem written by Rod at his own father's funeral. Hippies or cowboys? I don't know either fits those molds, but one can't miss the Guthrie in Slade or the roughness in Rod's voice. It's fitting that these two men, who recognized their respective roles in what would become Americana before the format existed, are based in Texas and Tennessee. It's also fitting that their roots are elsewhere. After all, Americana's roots are difficult to trace. Introduction. The down-home sound. They played dances, made the rounds, Galax to Rocky Mount. The tunes they knew no one could count. It was all in their heads and hands. Robbie Foulkes, Aunt Peg's New Old Man, 2016. Valdosta State University, like colleges and universities across the United States, dismissed students from physical classes in March 2020 in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. Professors, administrators, staff, and students returned to an entirely different campus experience the following August. Stepping into the classroom was a regular reminder of the changing world around us. Socially distanced desks meant most classes were divided such that students were at best attending classes once a week. Masked faces filled the rooms, and there was no leaning in to provide an encouraging word. Amid this relative academic dystopia, My fall schedule included a great deal of time in my office between classes, but the typical chatter among colleagues and students had largely evaporated. Silence, punctuated by the releasing cracks and thuds of opening and closing doors in our office suite, filled the resulting void. I can't work in silence. Music files and Pandora playlists provided two opportunities. First, they filled the silence, allowing me to focus on writing, grading, etc. Second, the music gave me an excuse to periodically walk into the common suite area and ask if the music was too loud or bothersome. The answer was never yes. During one of my more productive moments, Dr. Joseph Robbins approached my office as Jason Isbell sang and wondered aloud about the political leanings of Isbell's audience. As he spoke, I noticed Dr. Lakita Bennett Bailey's book, Pulse of the People, Political Rap Music and Black Politics, on my desk. This is the point I fell into this research. But it isn't the beginning. A decade before the pandemic, I was invited to participate in a conference on post-racialism at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln. As an assistant professor, recently removed from my doctoral program and very aware of my Southern Appalachian accent and the inability of my mouth to keep up with my mind, the conference was initially intimidating, despite the efforts of the late Dr. Michael Combs, who was generous to include me. At the opening dinner, I felt as if I was the only person there that didn't know everyone else. I took an open seat at a table that happened to be filled with only Nebraska professors. There were two empty seats to my left. Dr. Bennett Bailey sat next to me and began talking to me as if we had been raised together. We talked more about our daughters than our research that weekend, but I soon became familiar with her work. I initially thought meeting her was the beginning of this project. It wasn't. I realized the origins of this research during a phone call with Daryl Scott, who was coincidentally visiting family near Lincoln, Nebraska. Mr. Scott and I chatted about Kentucky and the generational impact of music. I thought about a similar conversation with Rodney Crowell, who also has some Kentucky roots, and I realized in that moment that, aside from fondness for old hounds, good Bloody Marys, and badly burned toast, music is likely all my dad and I have in common. My mind drifted to attending a few shows with him, and a moment during graduate school when he called to ask me to join him in East Tennessee to see Steve Earle. I had not told my parents that I had taken off to Boston that weekend. My youngest son joined me during the interview with Mr. Scott, and the conversation turned to my children sharing their mother and grandfather's musical tastes. "See, your family is an example," Mr. Scott observed before our conversation turned to my being raised and educated in a regional hotbed of strong roots music. Daryl Scott ignited my memory. I considered the obvious moments, my now husband Carrie taking me to see Bob Dylan for my birthday after we began dating, and then giving our daughter the middle name Dylan a few years later. Carrie withdrawing his phone from his pocket when we met Will Kimbrough, and Will saying, "prom pic," before beaming. Our searching Corpus Christi and Port Aransas for dive bars with good music during our time in Texas, which included traveling to San Antonio to see Todd Snyder play with John Prine. Carrie arguing with me about my seeing Robert Earl Keane without him at the Birchmere in Alexandria. Taking our children to see Old Crow Medicine Show in St. Augustine. The way our older son is instantly calmed when hearing Amanda Shires and Jason Isbell cover Warren Zevon's Mutineer, 1995. Laughing at our younger son, a toddler, when he sings Corb Lund's The Gothest Girl I Can, 2012. Then I dug deeper. I recalled shows, particularly Tim O'Brien, Buddy Miller, and Robbie Foulkes at the Laurel Theater in Knoxville, the Dame in Lexington, and Southgate House in Newport, Kentucky, respectively. I remembered a sorority sister, Jessica Harwood, introducing me to Todd Snyder in college. A few years later, I visited her in Atlanta, and we went to a show. It wasn't Snyder, but after we returned to her apartment, she gave me Songs for the Daily Planet on CD with a sideways glance and the corner of her lip drawn. I remembered the first time I ever saw Dylan play in Knoxville, wondering if the venue would be filled with old people. I recalled driving to Cincinnati with Todd to see Steve Earle and witnessing the dichotomous reactions of the crowd when Earle sang John Walker Blues, 2002. I remembered waking the morning after our friend's wedding and wondering if she would continue to have time for me, and subsequently driving from Louisville to Birmingham to attend a music festival. I recalled one of the few times during college I woke on a Sunday morning resolved to attend church. A friend had recommended a church somewhere outside of Moorhead. I got lost shortly after driving from the off-ramp. These were days when one didn't have the option of Google Maps readily available on their phone. I didn't find the church, but I found a bluegrass festival. John Paul White tells me that bluegrass is like religion, so I'm absolved of guilt. Later, I recalled another sorority sister, Sid, laughing about finding herself near Cave Run Lake in Kentucky at what appeared to be a dive bar listening to live bluegrass music. Old man jam session was her characterization. I recalled meeting someone in Knoxville who, perhaps unbeknownst to him, gave me the tools to see the music I enjoyed as a collectivity and introduced me to new artists and impressive local music, which included R.B. Morris's beautiful cover of John Prine's Late John Garfield Blues, 1972. Morris graced me with an interview for this book. Most of my friends would say that I have a terrible memory, and they would be correct. I nevertheless reeled from the memories following my conversation with Mr. Scott. Suddenly, I was a little girl on my grandparents' front porch in the head of the holler. I would never have admitted it until I was grown and long since moved away, but I loved breaking beans with my grandmother. I loved staring down the hill at the dirt road where Stephanie and I rode 10-speed bikes toward the creek, past the rusted-out pickup and derelict corn crib that had been converted to storage space. But mostly, I loved the sounds. The paper bag that held unbroken beans would rustle as Mama folded the rim, creating a wide cuff at the top, enabling her to see into the bag as she leaned over the arm of a gray, weathered rocking chair positioned to the side of the front door. She would withdraw a handful of beans and deposit them onto her lap before selecting a slim green victim. She then snapped off an end in such a way that she instantaneously peeled back a fragile corkscrew, revealing a darker seam down the center of the bean, then a firm, resounding crack, 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 crack. I was never able to produce the potent crack when breaking beans. I blame the beans. Mamaw then discarded the corkscrew into a growing lime green wig on the porch floor and placed the bean fragments into an enormous stainless steel bowl that had been dented so frequently that the dents appeared a purposeful aesthetic decision on the part of the manufacturer. Her long, thick fingernails scratched rhythmically against the metal. Meanwhile, Papaw sat in a twin rocker flanking the opposite side of the door, smoking and quietly singing Up on Cripple Creek. I had no idea who the band was at the time. Recalling my maternal grandfather easily transitioned to remembering my paternal grandfather and finally discovering the origin of this book. My father's father lived across the hill from us. I could walk across a narrow trail that created a crease in the steep incline of the mountain that connected our house to his, often encountering murky pools filled with black tadpoles. During one visit, I decided to clean his truck. I'm not sure what possessed me. He would have never asked me to clean, and while my memory is lacking, I don't recall being a kid that enjoyed anything resembling work. Nevertheless, I now remember very vividly cleaning the center console. a styrofoam cup containing a paper towel soaked with saliva, and what was once Wintergreen's skull was the centerpiece. I wish it had been Copenhagen. That would make for a better story. I was disgusted by the ghastly paper towel. Perhaps that's the reason I looked inside the glove box, to see something less revolting. There I found three cassettes. Two were Jimmy Buffett. The other was Jerry Jeff Walker. I was intrigued, and I stole them. I'm sure he knew that I took them, but he never mentioned it. That's the origin. Wintergreen skull, cassette tapes, and a child thief. These memories illustrate not only my experiences with this music, but also slices of the culture that surround it. My memory is punctuated not just with guitars, harmonicas, mandolins, fiddles, and thoughtful, rich lyrics. It's also colored by dirt roads, hollers, festivals, dive bars, amphitheaters, and interactions with other fans and staff, as well as the artists. Indeed, when Rod Picott discusses Americana, the culture and venues are pivotal. We all came up in the same bars. It was this beautiful sort of gathering place. It was like someone opened a home where everybody was invited, you know? The more I considered Picott's words, the more I realized that I did know, at least in part. But did everyone else? Much of this music lyrically reflects diversity as well as the inclusivity Picott describes. But that doesn't mean that American roots music intuitively signals that it is the home Picott found in the early days of Americana. As a heterosexual white woman that teaches and studies minority politics, I'm often an outsider. Despite the warm welcome I have always received from colleagues, many of whom have become close personal friends, I'm always aware I'm a bit different. I wouldn't say feeling embraced, yet somewhat outside, is uncomfortable. I've never felt uncomfortable, but I am aware I'm different. I wonder if the broad Americana culture is seen in a similar way by minority fans. There is certainly diversity in the origins of roots music, but that doesn't mean that minorities are represented across the industry. In fact, the artists interviewed in this volume want to increase their appeal to diverse audiences. They just aren't always quite sure how to do it. Further, appeal isn't limited to attending live shows. Much as Americans could benefit from learning about minority politics, even if they don't consider themselves members of specific minority groups, African Americans, LGBTQ plus Americans, Latinx Americans, Asian Americans, Native Americans, etc., could appreciate and connect to Americana if they saw how the music reflects their experiences and in turn incorporated the music into their lives. After all, as Angus Finnan, folk artist and executive director of Folk Alliance International, poignantly says, people are listening in their backyards and on their front porches. To that end, cultural commonalities and distinctions in this musical space are considered in the following. The down-home sound. Bob Dylan sang, "How many roads must a man walk down before you call him a man?" Howlin' Wolf asked, "How many more years have I got to let you dog me around?" John Prine crooned about the Indian Sabu's trek from the jungles of East St. Paul. Pete Seeger used his voice as a hammer to ring in love between my brothers and sisters all over this land. Jason Isbell took the stage at the Americana Music Awards in 2018 and belted out, "I'm a white man looking in a black man's eyes, wishing I'd never been one of the guys. We pretended not to hear another white man's joke. Oh, the times ain't forgotten." American roots music, comprised of many constituent genres, has long been associated with politics, diversity, and race. But political science has yet to explore the impact of Americana music. This research begins to fill that void by considering the message, the artists, the culture, and the impact. In turn, I use a mixed methods approach consisting of lyrical analyses, interviews with Americana artists, interviews with music journalists and festival organizers, and
sample complete. Ready to continue?